Welcome to Sound Living, a talk show on Sun Sounds of Arizona, designed to initiate conversation that generates inspiration, ideas, and resources to increase independence and improve life for people with disabilities. Our show is produced by Chuck Rinaldi, and I am your host, Caroline Becker. Each month, we bring you a guest to discuss a topic of interest in an interview-style format. In today's show, we bring you closer to the world of art as we get to know an international sculptor from his early life in Santa Clara Pueblo through a journey to a jungle in Vietnam and travels throughout the world to his present life in New Mexico, which he shares with his wife and children. For more than four decades, Michael Naranjo has made sculptures that are fluid in movement and tell stories of what he's seen and experienced in life. One writer referred to his work as what he cannot see with his eyes, but what exists in his mind and heart. Michael has been sculpting since the age of 23, after he was wounded and blinded by a grenade in Vietnam. He is a husband, the father of two daughters, residing in New Mexico, and currently Michael has an exhibit of 40 sculptures, 30 of which are designed to be touched, showing in Wickenburg, Arizona at the Desert Caballeros Museum through February 28th. There is also a free public lecture at noon on February 9th in the Cultural Crossroads Learning Center at that same museum. Welcome to Sound Living, Michael, and thank you for joining us by phone from New Mexico.
It's my pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
As am I. So you have led a remarkable life, growing up with nine siblings in Santa Clara, Pueblo, influenced by your mother, Rose, who was a potter and a successful ceramic artist. You studied at New Mexico Highlands University, taking classes in design and sculpture before being drafted in the Vietnam War. How long were you at university there?
I was there for 3 years before I was drafted, and I was drafted in June of 1967.
So you would have been 22 at that time?
I would have been 22 at that time.
Mm-hmm. And when you were at this university, were you an art major there?
I was an art major, and I had always intended to be connected to the arts in some shape, form, or manner. And many years ago, especially while I was at the university, I had seen films of Michelangelo sculptures, and even as a child, when I came across my mother's clay, I started creating pieces in clay, things children would make, little animals, and other children would make pinch pots, which most of the potters in Santa Clara, that is what they're known for, the black pottery. But I never enjoyed making pots. I simply made animals that I saw while wandering out in the woods with my brother.
So did you have a goal then to become a sculptor when you were in college?
I did have a goal to become a sculptor, and this was always my goal. But unfortunately, life doesn't always go the way we think it might, and I ended up being drafted, and of course, eventually ended up in a situation of which was a very life-changing moment in which I a hand grenade was thrown at me, and from that moment on, I was totally, completely blind.
So you were in Vietnam in the jungle, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this grenade came out of nowhere, and the next thing you knew, you were in hospital? Is that right?
Not quite. It's a bit more involved than that. We were caught in an ambush in an open rice field, and There were about 40 of us, and some of my friends never made it to the jungle, and when I made it into the jungle, of course, the enemy turned towards me because I was in there with them, along with my squad sergeant, and I heard my squad sergeant say something, and I was expecting more automatic weapons fire when we were in this little mud depression, and I ducked back into the mud depression and didn't want to put my weapon down in there with me because of the mud and afraid my weapon would jam. And
right.
So it was right on the edge, and I had just let go of my rifle when I felt this ball roll into my hand, and I gently hit my hand, and I knew immediately what it was, and I started to turn towards it, but I never did see it, and somewhere in the process of turning towards it, it exploded, and that was the last time I was able to see anything, and the last thing I remember was this man in a foxhole about 20 yards in front of me that I had just shot at.
Mm. So that ball was a grenade?
That ball was a grenade that was thrown at me, yes. And my squad sergeant did see it, and he went back, but I didn't understand what he said. Mm. And we had made it that far, that close to them.
Right.
And,
wow. Sounds terrifying.
War isn't a very, never is a very pleasant situation. Our veterans, our wounded warriors end up in, and fortunately, I made it home, and one never knows when they enter that that world. How they may return home, and if they will at all or not.
A very good point. Very good point.
So I came home, and a whole new different world was there waiting for me.
And you were in the hospital then overseas as well as in this country, or was it just a very short period of time before you were transferred home?
Once they took me through the jungle, four men put me in a poncho and took me through the jungle, back the way we came, and the dust off, the medevac came and picked me up and took me to an evacuation hospital in Vietnam, and was there for 2 weeks before I was taken to Japan, and I was there for a couple of months before I ended up at a hospital in Denver. It was Fitzsimmons General Hospital at that time, and there were it was especially there for soldiers which were coming back from the Vietnam War.
And which of these hospitals, was it the evac hospital in Vietnam where you asked a hospital volunteer for a piece of clay?
Well, actually, in between Vietnam and ending up in the United States in Denver, I was in a hospital in Japan for a while. And that's when a volunteer came along and asked if there was anything I needed. And we were in a gym, and there were just simply rows of us in this gym, and I was right underneath the basketball goal. And when this volunteer came and asked, I had been laying there. I had skin grafting on my arm, and my right arm is fairly well injured. It has minimal feeling and dexterity, and I my pinky, my small finger was later on amputated, and so I use that hand to hold pieces with, but I don't really work with it.
And that's your right hand.
That's my right hand.
And you are left-handed.
All the work that I do is with my left hand. The thumb, the pointer, and the middle finger, those are my eyes, essentially.
going back to that hospital in Japan and having this person bring you clay, I believe it was water-based clay. What did you do with that clay?
Once she brought it to me a few days later, I couldn't get out of bed at that point yet, and I thanked her for the clay, and it sat on the tray that you move in front of the bed when you can't get out, and they bring the food tray and whatever else you have sitting around you on top of that tray. So the block of clay sat there, and as I looked at it, and I had always had these dreams of becoming a sculptor, but suddenly finding oneself in a situation where you have one good hand and no eyes, you wonder what you can and can't do when it comes to creating anything three-dimensional in clay, and which I loved doing as a young man whenever I came across material. So I finally, after a few hours, tore off a piece of clay and rolled it up into a ball, and then rolled that out into a little squiggle. And what I was going to make was an inchworm, and I didn't know how it would turn out. And I pinched off the tail and lifted up one end of the clay and put a little mouth on it, put eyes on it, put lines around it, and a circle, something similar to a caterpillar.
Right.
And I suddenly became extremely excited.
You did.
Because I knew that I would still be able to sculpt, and I simply, it would take time, but it was kind of back to square one, and that's what children do when you give them a piece of clay often, is they roll it out and make a little snake or something.
Right.
And after that, I made a goldfish and the thinker. When I had seen photos of Rodin's thinker, and I ran out of clay. But I knew what I was going to do with my life at that point.
So you recognized in working with that you could do it.
Right. It made everything so much easier. And I think it deals with everyone in that way, that if we have direction and if we know what we're doing, where we're going, everything else helps to fall into place, and we can become more positive about it. And
right.
I was extremely happy that I was still going to be a sculptor. Mm.
And on that thought of having direction and things falling into place, after your hospitalization, you went to a school for the blind. Is that correct?
That is correct. After I was released from the hospital in Denver, I came home for a few weeks, and then I went to the Western Blind Rehabilitation Center in Palo Alto, California. And there were several of us, a dozen or so of us from Vietnam, and all young men who were visually impaired, and for the most part were totally blind. And I guess what we did there was we learned the basic aids of daily living to learn how to survive in this world. And it was there at that blind center that I entered a contest in a fire prevention week that they were having, and I made a clay sculpture of the Smoke of the Bear. It was an oil-based clay.
Oh.
And to my surprise, I won first prize in the patient contest. So I was excited about that.
That sounds exciting. It sounds like a high point. So after the school, then, you returned home for a time, but you did not stay there too long. Is that right?
That's correct. Fortunately, I had 9 brothers and sisters and a very loving family, and I didn't have to worry about where I was going to end up, and so I didn't have to worry about that. But once I returned home, and it was very strange because I knew everything around me, but yet I couldn't see any of it. So it was kind of like being born again. You had to learn how to read, write, walk with a cane, just all sorts of things. A whole new way of looking at life and approaching things, and so many different problems. But as time progressed, finding that if you want to do something bad enough, and you go about it and with a positive attitude, it makes a world of difference.
Yes.
And fortunately, that's kind of what happened. Except that my parents had so much TLC and wanted to do everything for me, so that after 2 months, I told them I was moving to Santa Fe, and they were living in Taos, northern part of the state, or Taos, New Mexico at the time. And Santa Fe was about 70 miles away, and I had a sister who was living there, and she helped me find an apartment, and so I moved into an apartment and started living.
So were you a starving artist in Santa Fe?
Just about, because what I had to do also in taking that step was that I lived alone in the apartment, and you have to learn how to cook, because
right?
If no one's going to cook for you, then that's what you have to do. So
right.
Started with all sorts of things that you can bake in the oven, of course, TV dinners, things like that, Popeyes,
right.
and eventually, as well, soup cans. But eventually, one day I made a hamburger, and I was so excited that that was just the beginning of things, and I later on eventually could bake a chicken and make pot roast and whatever else,
and this,
fry eggs.
This does sound exciting. I wonder if you would explain to our listeners, you've shared that you work with your thumb and two fingers on your left hand. So this is what you sculpt with. You can use your right hand, it looks like, for stabilization. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. I don't have very much strength in that hand. And if I hold, I can't make a complete so that if I try to hold a pencil between my thumb and pointer finger, it slips through my hand because I can't grasp with that hand. But if it's large enough, it has enough strength to hold something larger, well, the size of a Coke can or something like that, then I can hold on to it. And so, such being the case, the sculptures that I made during that time, I was creating pieces in wax, and so I could hold them. And I didn't use water-based clay anymore. I discovered that bronze sculptors quite often work with wax, and so I found where to go buy wax tools and set about starting to create pieces in wax.
So you got going on your career, in effect. And another thing I'm curious about, these sculptures of yours, many are meant to be touched. Tell us, why is that?
If you can't see, you have to be able to touch things. And this is the world that the visually impaired live in. Sound and touch become extremely important. And so going into galleries, and of course museums don't let you touch three-dimensional works of art, and in some galleries you can. And so over the years, I found that once I created pieces. And I guess what most artists, this thing that drives us is we create things, but we want to share them as well with the public out there, be it the visual or performing arts. And so I wanted people to see my work, and the only way that I could see other people's work was through touch. And so when museums denied me touch, eventually on years later, when I had was an established sculptor, then I had a touchable exhibit, and I wanted people to touch my pieces.
So in effect, then, you're talking about extending the senses, this idea of touch and of sound. And the exhibit that you have running in Wickenburg right now, there is a sound component to that, isn't there?
Correct. There is a sound component, and fortunately, we've had enough time so that my voice is on these handheld, I'm not sure what you call them, but anyway, handheld devices and these hearing devices, so that I describe the pieces, and anyone who is visually impaired can listen to my voice as I talk about why I made the piece and explain a little bit about what it might look like. But of course, the most important thing is touch, and so I'm grateful for the Desert Caballeros Museum there in Wickenburg for exhibiting my work in this manner, allowing the public to be able to touch the pieces. And the majority of the pieces there are from a collection called the Tia Collection, and so I'm grateful for that collection, who have the individual who's collected them and is willing to share them with the public.
Yes, and this is a very different experience for many of us in relationship to art, to be able to touch it. This is the opposite often of what happens in a museum or any venue where you would go to, quote, experience art. So it seems like a kind of a broadening, a sensory broadening.
Right. I've gone to museums with sighted people, and when I have permission to touch pieces, and my wife is extremely good at writing letters, so we generally write letters to museums if we're going to go to a certain city, or we have spent time in Europe where I was able to touch pieces there. So to get prior arrangement set in place for me to be able to touch things makes a great deal of difference in my wife being able to write these letters. But of course, museums don't let just anyone touch sculptures. But since it's my profession, and if someone who is an author goes into archives and looks at books, they're often granted permission because this is their profession. And so it makes a difference in how they go about with their work.
So it might be fair to say that you are, in a way, advocating for us all in terms of a greater experience of art.
I just want everyone to enjoy the pieces that I made, mm-hmm. in the same way that I made them, through touch. Mm-hmm. And often at these touchable exhibits that I've had over the years in various parts of the country, with the visually impaired as well as the sighted, there's always a sign in the museum that says, please touch, and people quite often take a double take on the sign. And
sure.
Am I sure I'm reading this correctly? Please touch?
Yes.
And so people will come up to me thanking me for the for creating this moment of being able to touch pieces in a museum, and quite often adults will come up crying and tears coming down, saying, thank you, this is what I've always wanted to do. And so it it's just a great way of sharing my work.
A moving experience, it sounds like. We have just a few moments left before, about 2 minutes before we're out of time for this first segment. But I have one last question for you. I read you reference your art as representational. Can you tell us what that means?
Representational is, if you look at my work, you can tell what it is. The animals that I created, anything from eagles and hawks to doves and horses and buffaloes and also the human figure. So you don't need, it's not abstract. I don't create abstract pieces. I do figurative work, and it's representational. It's not realistic.
I see.
As you would look at a photograph or someone, but it's definitely, you know what it is.
Understood. Thank you so much for clarifying that. That is all the time we have for this segment. Thanks to you, our guest, Michael Naranjo, for joining us and sharing your experiences and your insight and your creativity. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join us again. We air on the third and the fifth Saturdays, if there is a fifth Saturday of each month at 11 a.m. for editions of Sound Living. From myself, Caroline Becker, from our producer, Chuck Rinaldi, be well, take care, and please join us for another session with Michael Naranjo.